you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey there, Cynical listeners. We are very excited to bring you today a new podcast that I'm co-producing with our friends at GGV Capital. GGV is a Sand Hill Road VC with a long history of very successful investing in China. The podcast is called 996, and you'll understand why shortly. It's hosted by Hans Tung, a partner at GGV and a super knowledgeable technologist himself, and by Zara Zhang, who is an investment analyst at the firm and a former tech reporter who is very, very smart. The show is going to be out every other week, but this week we are launching the first four episodes. First up is Jerry Yang, co-founder and former CEO at Yahoo, who has been actively involved in the China tech scene for a very long time. He, of course, was the person who engineered the deal with Alibaba. It's an extraordinary interview, and whether you are a techie yourself, or an entrepreneur, or a China watcher, or an investor, you're going to get a lot out of this one, I promise. And stay tuned for more. We've got Liu Jun, who headed strategy for Uber in China and is now a senior VP at ByteDance, the company that produces the AI-powered news provider Toutiao. We've got the AI maven Andrew Ng, who used to be at Baidu, and the eminence grise of the China tech world, the legendary Kai-Fu Lee. Enjoy the podcast, and if you like it, please subscribe. Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Beijing. We will be arriving at Zhongli and Beijing Capital International Airport. Now the local time is 6 o'clock in the evening.
Hi there. Welcome to the 996 podcast, brought to you by GGV Capital and co-produced by the Seneca Podcast. On this show, we interview movers and shakers of China's tech industry, as well as tech leaders who have a U.S.-China cross-border perspective. My name is Hans Tung. I'm a managing partner at GGV Capital and have been working at startups and investing in them in both the U.S. and China for the past 20 years.
My name is Zara Zhang. I'm an investment analyst at GGV Capital and a former journalist. Why is this show called 996? 996 is the work schedule that many Chinese founders have organically adopted. That is, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week.
To us, 996 captures the intensity, drive, and speed of Chinese internet companies, many of which are moving faster than even their American counterparts.
On the show today, we have Jerry Yan, the co-founder and former CEO of Yahoo and the founding partner of Ame Cloud Ventures, which focuses on seed to later stage companies building infrastructure and value chains around data. Jerry was a pioneer in the consumer internet industry, an icon of Silicon Valley, and has been an inspiration to both engineers and entrepreneurs worldwide.
Jerry also orchestrated one of the most famous and lucrative deals in tech history anywhere in the world. In 2005, he arranged for Yahoo to invest $1 billion in cash plus the asset of Yahoo China in exchange for a 40% stake in a small but fast-growing Chinese company by the name of Alibaba, which happened to be a GGV portfolio already back then. The post-money valuation of the deal was for $5 billion. The deal was considered by many as being expensive and risky. It was also the largest foreign investment ever made in Chinese tech industry. Today, 12 years later, Alibaba is worth close to $500 billion, or half a trillion, and for a return of 100x in 10 years for Yahoo.
Jerry remains active on the U.S.-China cross-border technology scene. He's on the board of Alibaba and Lenovo, speaks frequently at various events, and advises U.S. tech companies looking to go to China, as well as Chinese tech companies trying to expand into the U.S. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's a great way to kick off 2018.
Yeah, glad to have you here. Thank you for coming. You first met Jack during your first visit to China in 1997. Let's go back and chat about that context. He was a government official assigned to you to be a translator and take you around on the Great Wall. At that time, what was your impression of him? And back then, did you have any inkling at all he was going to do something big over the next few decades? back then, you were the king of internet. Yahoo was the highest valued internet company in the entire world. What struck you about China back then?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in Taiwan, as you well know, Hans. And and since I came to the U.S., I never went back to Asia very often. And so being able to go back to China for the first time in 1997 was a thrill. And, you know, meeting Jack then was very interesting because I was immediately struck by how inquisitive and how curious he was about the internet. And the internet was not very big in China in 1997. Jack spoke great English. He never spent time outside of China, so he learned it in China, which was also very unusual back then. But it was clear that he was an entrepreneur at heart, even from 1997. Now, of course, I had no idea what he would go on to do. He may not have had any idea what he was going to go on to do.
Right. And I think so, China had, what, like 7 million internet users back
then? It was very, very small, and the internet connections were terrible. And so this was very much an early days kind of a time. So I would say that over time, obviously, the country embraced the internet. But at that time, it was really kind of early days in the backwaters.
Did you guys talk about the internet at all?
Yeah, he was very inquisitive. He asked about the web. He asked about the internet. And he asked about all the information part of it. I think he had some experience building directories or things like that for telecommunication.
Yellow Pages.
Yeah. So he was very knowledgeable about a lot of aspects of what Yahoo was back then, which was a large directory and a search engine. So we did talk a lot about that. And he clearly was not your typical government person.
Right. Back then, all throughout Asia, people were trying to figure out what internet is, what internet meant. And I think that at that time, the market leaders in Taiwan, China, or Hong Kong, Japan were just starting. What was your impression of Asia's potential for internet market at that time?
Well, in 1997, when I visited China and first met Jack, this was on the heels of the previous year, 1996, started Yahoo Japan with SoftBank and Masayoshi Son. So Masa, as he is now, is very much a visionary. He pushes and wants to be 10 and 20 years ahead of where the trend is.
Right.
And he saw the opportunity. He was one of our first investors in Yahoo in the late stage, right before we went public. But also his condition was to start Yahoo in Japan. And I think we were in no position back then. We were a young company. I think we had less than 50 people.
Right.
And we were too busy in the US. But he was so persistent and forceful, as Masa is still today, that we agreed to launch Yahoo Japan in probably some sort of a record time. He supplied all the labor. He put some of his best executive. He even put his younger brother, Taizo, as one of our lead surfers. So we had launched Yahoo Japan the previous year, and it was difficult to get it launched.
Right.
But then we saw the early successes of having been first to market there. And so to your question, I think there is this very palpable energy around Asia, not only in Japan, but in Korea. Exactly. Korea was really just beginning to take off. And then obviously China wasn't far behind.
Right. Since Yahoo Japan worked out so well over time, were you thinking of doing something similar, even as early as then, for other parts of Asia?
Yeah, we try to do the same model elsewhere. We try to do Yahoo Korea. It did not work out as well. And I think there were some very strong incumbent competitors in Korea that has turned out to be, you know, huge.
Right, like Dom.
Dom and Naver and those guys. And in China, we knew we had to plant the flag early and try to get some things going. But also, ultimately, we needed partners to survive in China, given not only the market, which is usually the driving factor, but in China, you also have the government and the regulatory side of it that made it very unique.
Correct.
And as you know, it's not easy for a U.S. tech company to operate in China. What do you think are some of the most common challenges faced by U.S. companies when they try to go to China?
Well, I think the number one is really understanding what is the goal and how do you succeed? How do you define success? And and part of the early days of the internet in China, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s, the challenge were really that the regulatory side was just also growing up. So they were trying to figure out how to regulate the internet industry at the same time all these companies were coming up. So some companies were less regulated than others, and right. And I think now there is a more or less more clear roadmap for companies that want to be in China. And I think as the last 20 years have shown, the government also has been they've been open on some ways and closed in other ways mm-hmm. about letting companies in. And I think part of it is having partners or having investors, maybe like GGB yourselves, who understands sort of the highs and lows or the rise and fall of different sensibilities within mm-hmm. the Chinese culture and the Chinese government.
On the topic of local partners, how do you pick a local partner that fits your company culture, and how do you make sure that they're actually empowered?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Zara. I think we were very lucky in Japan to have SoftBank as our local partner who put all of their weight behind us. Japan is notoriously difficult as a market.
Right.
And for us to have had Masa's support and backing was really critical. But it was also one where we, you know, he had the majority of equity in Yahoo Japan. So it was a case where he had more of the stake of the company for us to. In order for us to be successful there. In other places, I think it just depends. It really, if you can find a great local team and local manager, a lot of times that's the key ingredient, whether you find a partner or not. And it depends on kind of company, because if it's a large-ish company and there isn't so much local innovation or product localization that's required, that's one formula, and we've seen a lot of U.S. companies that basically use the market as more of a sales and marketing market, whereas a lot of our companies today, especially our venture companies and portfolio companies, do require not only product rollout, but also some indigenous localization or innovation mm-hmm. that needs to happen. And there you need more talented executive teams than just your standard sales and marketing executives. So it really kind of depends on it, but ultimately it comes down to running the business. You know, people get stuck on running, finding equity partners or government partners or capital, you know, but ultimately it's who's running the business day to day on the ground and growing the marketplace. And our successful examples tend to be people who are great getting the product out into the market that fits the Chinese market. And I think that's a secret sauce that's hard to come by. And it helps to have other backing and other capital partners, but usually it's much more about the people on the ground.
Right. You had a few attempts at this in China.
Yes.
Obviously, the most recent one, the final one, worked out extremely well.
Yeah.
It's the best thing one could argue that Yahoo ever did after initial inception. Before that, for example, you worked with Zhou Hongyi of 371.
Yes, right.
Extremely controversial figure who now runs Qihoo 360.
Yeah.
How did you decide to pick him in the first place over someone like a Robin Li or anyone else in China? And then was insisting on having a 100% ownership via acquisition the right strategy, or what you did the second time with Jack, a partial but material stake, would that be a better strategy for a U.S. company looking at expanding to China in the internet space?
Well, we realized that in China that we needed a local operating person. As I said, being in China, running a product set without local executive team was very, very difficult. And this was still before the regulatory side was clear about what Yahoo is allowed to do or is not allowed to do. So we did acquire 3721 and really used the acquisition to buy the management team, which is Zhou Hongyi and his team. Hongyi is, as you know, he's very scrappy. He's bold. He's got the...
Doesn't play by the Western rules.
Well, he doesn't really... He really just sees himself as a true maverick. And especially, you know, this is almost 20 years ago, he was really a maverick.
Right.
And so I would say that my experience with him has been challenged from the standpoint of him being a subsidiary within a large U.S. company at the time. But his approach to the Chinese market, his sort of ability to kind of come up with things that really can disrupt the market, to this day he has done that. I actually learned a lot from him. And, you know, our episode in China the challenge was, and is now kind of a seminal moment, if you will, was meeting with the government officials and them in not so uncertain terms, saying that, you know, Yahoo really shouldn't be operating in China, and or even what was the word they said, that you know, we have this regulation that's coming up next year that will make what you guys are doing illegal. And of course, it's a regulation I think that never got passed, but you kind of get the idea that, you know, they really suggested that we don't operate in the media and information business in China. So that was when we got the hint, and we said, well, you know, if we're gonna pull out of China, we want to put our efforts with somebody that we think could be a winner.
And this was with, even with the 3721 acquisition already?
Yes, this is post 3721.
I see.
Because we owned it 100%, and the government was not really keen on having a foreign-owned entity that has potential information and media presence. So we knew we had to get out.
If you were selling Starbucks coffee, you wouldn't have this issue.
Yeah. And you know, and part of the debate was, you know, if we're going to leave China, we should parlay our assets there into something else. And right, that's when we went down this investment path. And obviously, by that time, we've reconnected with Jack. But also, more importantly, that e-commerce was not an area that was subject to foreign investment. And so we felt that if we can translate our holdings in China or operations in China into an investment in a minority investment, the government would be fine with that. And obviously in the area of e-commerce, that was fine. So that's how we ended up at least sequentially get there.
So the deal was 1 billion cash plus Yahoo China.
Yes.
For 40% stake in Alibaba.
Correct.
And so I think the valuation of Alibaba afterwards was at 5 billion?
5 billion post.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's why it should be 5 billion post.
Yeah. Or maybe that was pre. Depending on how much you value Yahoo China, right? So,
But I remember, I mean, this was done in
2005.
2005, after the HISTA summit in May,
right,
in Pebble Beach. And when that was announced in, I think it was June or July, it was earth shattering, because it was on the heel of Baidu gone public. Valuation quadruple post listing to about 5 billion, and you have two $5 billion company, one public, one private in China. Now, everyone said these companies had no business being valued much. There's just not enough revenue to ever justify it. How were you able to make that decision to do this and commit 1/3 of cash on Yahoo balance sheet? I mean, I will argue, without you as a CEO, this deal would never have gotten done.
Well, I wasn't the CEO. Terry Summer was the CEO. But Terry was with me in China at that moment when the government told us that we couldn't be in China anymore. And Terry was extremely positive about China and, quite frankly, you know, doesn't get enough credit for all the things we did there. But we, you know, in my mind and thinking back about it, it was a very obvious thing to do. And I think a lot of people say this about decisions that you feel good about or right decisions, that you don't really think of all the difficulties. But I think in retrospect, you're right. It is a huge investment for a company like Yahoo to use that much of our cash to bet on that kind of valuation on that market.
In an unproven market.
Unproven.
Completely unproven.
Yeah, but I think there are a couple of, obviously, guideposts. One is, you know, we saw the success in Japan, where we were in the auction business and commerce business. And we saw, you know, betting on the leader, even though there's not a lot of tech, you know, there's a lot of marketplace dynamics that are already starting to take effect. And the second thing, which I've talked about publicly, is that during the time we were running Yahoo China, whether it's through our team or with Zhou Hongyi, we tried to establish our e-commerce business using the same playbook that we did in Japan, and we were just getting killed and completely annihilated by Taobao. And so we knew how fierce and how smart and how strategic, both, you know, on the grand level, but also on the tactical level, Jack and his team was. And I think that we, through that competition, we grew, you know, we became very respectful of his capabilities. So so it was kind of in this humbling experience of having competed with Jack that we realized we'd rather partner with him than try to compete with him. And I think Jack and Alibaba benefited from that investment as well. They really, yes, like you said, you know, put him on the map as sort of the leading internet company in China.
Yeah.
And so it was the right time, clearly. We were very lucky.
Clearly we win.
Yeah.
Besides Jack and Alibaba, how appealing was working with someone like a Robin Li and Baidu or Pony Ma and Tencent to you back then?
Well, I think...
You had your choice.
Well, I don't know if we had our choice, but clearly they are great entrepreneurs and they are proving, you know, if you look at Pony... You know,
with QQ and WeChat.
WeChat, you know, the acquisition of WeChat turned out to be one of the seminal...
From Foxmail to WeChat, come on.
Yeah, it's great unbelievable. Deal. And you know, we could talk about their history and how they've made multiple transitions in business models and into success. So, but I would say that the simple answer is that while they're great entrepreneurs, for Yahoo to be involved in search, which is Baidu, or in QQ, which
messaging.
Is communications and messaging, would have been difficult. And I think e-commerce was the obvious safe place for us to be
from a government view standpoint.
Correct.
Got it. So that was a factor as well.
Yep.
And you mentioned earlier about getting very clear understanding from Chinese government what you could or could not do in China.
Well, I didn't say it was clear. It was clear that we couldn't do it. But it was never clear that you could do something. So you try and you hope that you're reading the tea leaves correctly along the way.
Yeah. Right. So in that context, do you think that switching the topic a little bit, that Travis and Uber decided to do a deal with Didi, which was a DiDi portfolio, to sell Uber China to DiDi in exchange for a stake in DiDi and have DiDi have a stake in Uber in the US as well. Do you think that was a similar context 10 years later?
I you know, I'm an observer on the board for DiDi, and but I don't really know the details of that transaction. My guess is that there was some government, certainly agreement for them to, you know, first of all, there had to be some sort of government approval for Didi and Kuaidi to merge previously.
Right.
And then when Didi and Uber resolved their competition in China, the government had to at least let it happen because they're essentially the last two players left.
Right.
So whether there was significant issues with Uber being a U.S. company in China, you certainly can speculate that, you know, if you have massive amounts of data around transportation and routes and people's moving patterns, that could be construed as something that's sensitive. And so, but whether that really was a factor or not, who knows? I mean, I wasn't part of this discussion.
Trava had shared in certain circles that his understanding from Chinese government was a subsidy, in his case, ends up being illegal soon. and if that's the best way for Uber to catch up, Uber obviously need to think twice about what to do.
Yeah, welcome to China.
Right. Well, on that note, same thing happened here as well in the U.S., where Alibaba's most recent interest in acquiring a payment processor in the U.S. was denied. And this is even after Jack had already famously met with President Trump and had a great conversation, and for President Trump to praise him afterwards. So it seems like there's just a lot of politics and polarization around U.S.-China business dealings in a way that's not really aligned with the underlying business economics and interest.
Yeah, I think it's one of our, given GGV's interests and a lot of our investment commonalities, is obviously cross-border. And I think the U.S.-China cross-border issues are getting more complex rather than less. And as tech companies become bigger and bigger, if you look at Alibaba or Amazon or, you know, obviously your FANG stocks and companies, there are enormous complexities now, you know, with regards to how these deals are evaluated or proposed deals. And it's not even just internet deals, right? I mean, if you look at all the semiconductor deals in the last couple of years, the regulatory body in the U.S., which is CFIUS, is largely a political body. So I think it becomes much more difficult for sort of these bigger companies to do deals that may touch on other people. So you can imagine it's not maybe just the government that don't want certain deals to happen like the one you're talking about. Maybe other companies that don't want that to happen, then they will lobby.
A lot of lobbying.
Yeah. So I think it's a politicized issue right now between the two countries. We certainly hope that that environment and atmosphere will change over time, as I think the best outcome is for more free flowing of products and ideas and capabilities and markets. But for now, it seems like we're entering more of a more cautious time between the two countries.
Right. I know that, for example, from the perspective of Visa and MasterCard, they are extremely wary of Alipay and Tenpay. The China volume of Alipay and Tenpay together is becoming closer and closer to what Visa and MasterCard are doing on a global basis outside of China. So it's, like you said, it's not just a political issue, but also for other players in the market, people are just wary of the fast expansion that Chinese companies have on them more in general.
Right.
And with Chinese tourists being the fast-growing outbound traffic anywhere, and the spending power that you put on top of that, it makes any existing player in any domestic market in other countries wary of what could happen. So it's almost as if, this may not be the perfect analogy, that the Chinese company and the U.S. company are going after different parts of the world. We see that, as you probably have seen as well, U.S. companies do better in Western Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, to some extent Latin America, and especially the executives of India descent in American companies have shown that they can do well in India as well. Whereas the Chinese companies do better in Southeast Asia, including Indonesia, the Muslim countries in the Middle East and North Africa, and to some extent into Eastern Europe. Yeah. Seems like the world is almost dividing into half. And you look at the Chinese politics of One Belt, One Road expanding into Middle East, Eastern Europe, parts of different parts of Europe and North and Africa in general, that the world is becoming more and more into these two camps.
Yeah, and it's not clear how whether it is really two camps or not. I think as the U.S. current policy tends to be, you know, retrenching from a lot of our even, you know, longtime allies, it's unclear how even the U.S. influence in foreign markets will continue. But I do think, and Evan Osnos wrote, you know, inadvertently or you know, I think he wrote it yesterday or today that the U.S. is helping make China great. Right. And I think part of it,
article on Twitter and LinkedIn this morning. Yeah.
But I think part of it is, as you said, that the government policy of One Belt, One Road is taking a lot of government resources to build infrastructure, to build ties and development into Southeast Asia, sort of the Indochina and in Indonesia. And then, you know, sort of, westward through the stands and into Africa. And so it won't be surprising, I think, to see Chinese companies also, the private sector, being taken advantage of the sort of the tailwind that the government is supplying.
Right.
So if you had the chance to do it again, would you have tried operating in China from day one, or would you have picked a local or invested in a local company from day one?
I you know, those are hard questions, because I think with our experience, it was a moment in time. You know, today, if you were to try to start, you know, you wouldn't start what we started back then, because the rules are more clear, the more players, the market is more developed. So, you know, we would have to find another kind of a greenfield, early stage endeavor to have that question. But I would say that having spent the time of trying to operate in China, having spent the time through acquisitions and trying to acquire a Chinese company, having spent the time competed with Taobao and Alibaba, you know, it led us to this very, as I said, almost a natural, an obvious decision to invest in Alibaba, which I don't think we would have done had we gone in there trying to invest, you know, as a pure investor, because we didn't have the skill set of being an investor. Or or trying to find a partner. And believe me, we try to find partners, but finding a JV partner or something else would have been, I think, also very complex. So it's because, you know, it's almost like the old saying goes, you know, every step we took, it was for a reason. And I never imagined that by investing Alibaba in 2005, we would end up having Alibaba being nearly a $500 billion company. But certainly we felt like they were our best chance to be successful in China through their hard work and their perseverance.
What kind of advice do you give to U.S. companies who seek your advice as they try to go to China? And what do you think big companies like Facebook or Airbnb should do as they approach the Chinese market?
Well, I think I tell a lot of our companies to try to go early, not necessarily to set up a very inflexible joint venture or anything like that, but go early to explore the market, get to know people, build relationships, understand the market, and understand their product market fit. It really is two different worlds now. I think the Chinese market, especially almost in every market, B2B, B2C, is, I think, as different in China as in as anywhere else from the U.S. So there is no sort of, hey, we can do what we did in the U.S. and it'll work in China. Probably more the other way around these days. So I'm sure we'll get to that. So, yep. So that's one thing, is to just to understand China early and meet people early. And the second thing is, if there really is an ambition to China, there has to be a plan, but also you have to probably go in there before too big. And I think there is some wariness by the multiple different factions within China, whether it's the government or the private sector or whoever, to say, hey, you know, if you're a large company like Airbnb or Facebook coming to China, you know, there is more worry about them coming in and going against what a government policy is or government agenda is. I think Airbnb probably has had more success than, say, Facebook. But over time, I think all these things will play out in a way that it really depends on, I think, what the market would accept in China and the government would accept in China. But I think by going somewhat early helps companies not have that big sort of company syndrome being put on them. It's much tougher on the company because they're not big. But I think if they really view China as a core market, then they should do that sooner rather than later.
I guess the lesson is that it's never too early to factor China into your growth plan and hire people who
have China knowledge. I think it could be I think if you ran a company or used to run companies, you know, you think about entering markets in 12, 24, maybe, you know, on the outset, 36 months. And I think in China, you just have to think much longer term. It may take you 5 years to get anywhere. It may take you 10 years. And we know plenty of companies that have been there for a long time and still have very little market share, but they're continuing to work and trying to cultivate relationships. And so China, I say this to a lot of our company, China is not a place for transactions. China is really a place for relationships. Mm-hmm. And if you view it as a transaction to say, hey, we're going to start a JV, we're going to knock this off of our checklist and we're going to move on to the next country, chances are it's not going to go well. Yeah. And whereas I think if those people who really sustain, commit capital, and, you know, now China want you, you know, China by and large wants the companies to go to their country and do something for them. You know, they're China now, right?
Right.
So this isn't 20 years ago. So the China status has also changed. So I think it really takes a different kind of attitude and long-term view.
Yeah, it's not just another market.
Right.
It seems like any founding team in the U.S., if you don't have someone who's from China originally or of Chinese descent, it makes it a lot harder to understand China. We are both in Wish, Peter's fantastic, and also having Danny, who's a co-founder, who's from China, makes it a lot easier for Wish to figure out how to leverage China for its global ambition.
Well, yeah, and I think, these are all generations, right? I think right now there are, in your example, you're exactly right, having somebody that understood China and Chinese and can go back there and function there, which is not all the Chinese people can. I can't go back and function there, but Danny can. And I think that's critical. But I think over time, as China becomes a market that everybody has to be able to expose themselves to, because it probably, you know, right now is still the U.S. and maybe Western Europe, but pretty soon China is the top one or two market that you have to be successful at if you're building a company. So that may or may not be exclusively the domain of people who are Chinese. I mean, you know, but so far it has been that you really takes a while to really understand China, and you know, being an expat there is not the easiest thing to do.
No.
In a very, very dynamic, competitive environment. I mean, your show is called, you know, 996, right? I mean, that's a very shocking kind of thing for people who visit there, right, from Silicon Valley.
9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 7 days a week. That's the worst schedule in internet space in China. If we look at just two sets of data points, look at the valuation of Amazon versus Alibaba. Alibaba is somewhere around 80%, 90% valuation of Amazon. Alibaba arguably has all of China and parts of Southeast Asia. And Amazon has, you know, worldwide market. You have some presence in China. Yet the valuation is very close. You look at Didi versus Uber. Didi started 4 years after Uber did. Didi, you're not an observer on their board. They are primarily a Chinese company with strategic investments elsewhere, outside of China. And Uber has, you know, all around the world with minority stake in China. Yet the valuation of the two companies are very similar to each other now. So the Chinese market has just been, for the right mobile internet company who has the right product market fit and who do work in 996, can build a company and scale them much faster than anybody else who has the rest of the world. That has never happened before.
Yeah.
What does that mean and how it's going to impact Silicon Valley? I've noticed some of the smartest product people in Silicon Valley are increasingly paying attention to what's happening in China with WeChat, with Alipay, and so forth. And that has changed the way they think about building product in the US and for other markets. Is that a growing trend, or is it just more of an anomaly still? If you had to make a prediction, five, especially 10 years down the road, how would the teams in Silicon Valley think about these different things going on?
It's a really good question. And I think part of the reality is that the volume that, you know, the companies that you talk about, whether it's, you know, Alibaba or Tencent or Didi, the volume they do every day astounds. You know, people who don't spend time there.
Yeah.
So it's adding another zero, sometimes two zeros, when you talk about
skill in China.
Whether it's Meituan doing deliveries or, you know, doing number of transactions in Alipay and Tencent and Tenpay, or the number of rides that Didi gives, you know, it's there is a scale factor that is extremely important, I think, when people are developing products in China, is that, you know, they don't necessarily need the fanciest technologists, but they got to handle the kind of scale that's much, much, much higher out of the gate, right? And be stable. And so there's a an element of, and as those companies grow and as those companies scale, they can take that advantage of stability and scale elsewhere that U.S. companies may have to redo to get the kind of scale elsewhere, especially if they go to China, for example. Right. So that's one element. The other element, I think, is that there is still a lot of more fundamental innovation here in Silicon Valley. It is still the melting pot of the world's best entrepreneurs. You know, we have entrepreneurs, you and I both probably have entrepreneurs from every country, every ethnicity, and so it's a very diverse set of entrepreneurs. And I think in China it's still relatively monolithic in terms of they're mostly Chinese. But you're starting to see innovation that is really for China market's sake, really indigenous and really local. And you're seeing business models develop, and you're seeing, because of the scale and you're seeing the density of the population, allow certain things to happen in China that won't happen in US. So we're seeing business model differences, right? Not just technology or product differences, but really starting to see business model differences.
Right.
And I think that's what's going to happen in 5 to 10 years, where you're going to have business models that really are innovative and different in China than the US. I'm a little closer to Alibaba, but, you know, the new retail that Alibaba is advancing, you know, it's really hard to do here in the US, but it really works in China. So that I think you're just beginning to see China going from, you know, you could say the early days of the internet being sort of a copycat culture, mm-hmm. to more indigenous development for local market and products, which has now graduated to more indigenous business models and innovation. And when you have all those things really working, it's kind of like a flywheel, right? The business models,
correct.
You get business models, and you're seeing not only Alibaba, Tencent, and Baidu being large players in their own ecosystems in terms of investment and M&A, you're seeing their next generation in Didi and Meituan, and those people are now very aggressive investors in M&A as well. So they're really creating their own sort of ecosystem there.
I think part of the reason things scale so fast in China is due to the leapfrogging effect. So
sure.
China skipped credit cards into mobile payment, skipped on-premise software into SaaS, skipped landline to mobile. How much do you think the growth can be attributed to this effect, and how can companies continue to scale once this low-hanging fruits are already picked?
It's a great question. I do think leapfrog has been a great benefit to China, but you also have to remember India could have done the same leapfrogging. Mm-hmm. And by most measures, they're...
Most developing countries could all have leapfrog.
They could have all done it. And
so what made China different?
Right. And so I think there is... and you know, by most measure, India is far behind China when they could have arguably been about the same starting point in the mid-90s or late 90s, right? So, so I do think that the leapfrog is something that China as a country were very conscious of trying to take advantage of, and it's probably a lot of it is the government leadership, but a lot of it is, I think, the entrepreneurial spirit to say, hey, you know, we're going to solve a problem, and we're going to solve a problem with no existing infrastructure, and whether it's logistics, which they didn't have a vast logistics network like UPS or FedEx or whatever, or like you said, landline versus mobile phones, or a number of other ways in which China developed faster than the U.S. And I think e-commerce is one of them, right? I mean, for a while, retail and e-commerce coexisted, but it's clear that e-commerce has more benefit without having to go build a bunch of malls and stores. So I think there is a conscious effort for China to do these leapfrogging moves. Now, I think over time, you know, as things scale, it's harder and harder to leapfrog. You can't really leapfrog existing, you know, scaled infrastructure. So that may slow down growth at some point, which it has to slow down at some point. But the question really is there new areas in which they can grow just as fast from leapfrogging perspective? And that's, you mentioned cloud and SaaS. I think there's actually an argument to be made that SaaS in China is still very much the early days. You know, there's not a very, yes, AliCloud is a big player, AWS is just getting started there, but it's not like here where, you know, major businesses are running on the cloud. There are still a lot of room to grow, I think, in digital media in China online, and I think that's an area where there's still a lot of opportunity. So my guess is that, you know, as area mature, they need to continue to find leapfrogging opportunities, and it's not surprising that a lot of these large internet companies in China are starting to look outside of China. You know, Indonesia being a key battleground for a lot of companies, but yep. But it's going to happen elsewhere in the world as well.
Yeah, it seems like the question that Zara just posed, a lot of smart journalists in the West, especially New York Times or the Information Rico, asked similar question, thinking that China benefit because it was behind and leapfrog. Now, you know, it's easier. Somehow it implies it's easier. But if you and I look at the quality of entrepreneurs from the portal days to the gaming days, to the search messaging e-commerce days, now to the mobile internet days, the quality of engineers continue to go up.
Yeah.
And for one reason or the other, a lot of these smart people may have been educated or working in the US, whether it's due to glass ceiling or other factors. It kind of prompt them to try to go back to China and make it work there rather than be here to do it. And not to make this into a China-India comparison, but a lot of Indian executives who may have been entrepreneurs in India ends up being very successful in the Valley, in Boston, in Seattle, and so forth. So the talent that would have, the comparable talent that may have been able to propel India to the next level ends up staying here in the US, whereas the same level quality of talent ends up going back to China and start this whole new internet sector. And obviously the government played a part in allowing that to happen and now try to overregulate it too much.
Yeah.
And so one thing I also noticed is that for the Chinese entrepreneurs over these four generations, in some sense, we are lucky that internet was the time that this awakening happened and the spirit of internet made it possible to continue to come up with new ways to increase efficiency into an ecosystem in which, I mean, who would have thought that 10 years ago, the most valuable companies in China would be non-government owned, right. i.e. Alibaba and right. Tencent in 2005, 2006. There was China Petrochemical, it was China Mobile, it right. was ICBC Bank. These days, that you have number one, number two most valuable company in China being completely privatized and run by entrepreneurs. And that trend could accelerate over the next 10 years. Then that's just something that no one would have thought possible 10 years ago. So something about internet, something that fit Chinese innovation and entrepreneurial spirit that kind of enhance each other to make this great change in China. The question is, could that be exported to Indonesia, yeah. to Middle East, to other countries where One Belt, One Road may play a factor? And somehow this model can be a interesting developing model for other emerging markets that didn't have, may not have been able to do that on their own, but now could be affected by China.
It's a great question, Hans. And I think, you know, if just to go back on something you said, I think there's a little bit of another perspective with regards to Chinese entrepreneurs. I think that as the China market has taken off and started rising, quite frankly, there were probably more opportunities for them to go back from a career and contribution standpoint than staying here in the U.S. I don't know if there's really a glass ceiling. We can get into that, but obviously there's no glass ceiling for Indian tech executives and a number of other ethnicities. So it may just be that the opportunity in China is much bigger, and you could probably argue that, you know, for Indian global executives to go back to India, what are they going to do there, right? So it really does speak to the rise of China's economy and the rise of China's development to attract, to make that, make coming back for a lot of these overseas Chinese to be attractive. Not all of them have been successful, but I think that there continues to be a massive need for talent in China. Mm-hmm. And so there is no question that as you think about, you know, you highlighted a number of great entrepreneurs in China, but you know, you need hundreds of thousands of skilled tech workers and programmers and coders and developers, and now, you know, big data and AI capable engineers. These are in extreme shortage in China, even right. though they're trying to crank them out. So to me, it's more of the opportunity back in the market that they have the heritage from rather than anything else. And to that point, the question is, can Chinese companies expand outside of China or help countries, markets that have not been developed outside of China? I think that's the next big question and the next big phase mm-hmm. for China's growth. Everybody's trying to do it a little bit differently. I think governments are getting smarter post Uber and post all these companies come in. And so it's going to be less straightforward, I think, than the past 20 years.
Right.
You're going to deal with local regulations. You're going to deal with local people, probably day one, especially if you're a large company. And so these become sort of upfront negotiated political government deals in many instances, and so I think it takes a different skill set to maneuver in all these different countries who all have different needs, and being able to kind of create not only a sustainable market but also develop talent locally, because it's hard to export a bunch of Chinese managers into a country for a very, very long time. You
right.
know, we've seen kind of Japan try to do that. Didn't work in the 80s and yep. 90s, and so it's got to be a different way. Nobody knows what it is yet, but I think it's gonna be the next big challenge for a lot of these companies.
Right. You obviously are very, very much aware of Alibaba's acquisition in Southeast Asia and exporting Chinese managers to work in Southeast Asia. We also have seen other companies in Hangzhou building up sizable presence, do a lot of local hires in Middle East.
Right.
And it's also in the area of e-commerce, exporting Chinese goods, curated more like a Tmall model to markets in the Muslim countries. And they're growing extremely fast. And you can tell that the consumers in Muslim countries just are not used to getting this influx of goods at such cheap, affordable prices. And so good quality at great prices, it's a great formula for emerging markets yeah. worldwide. And so it seems like the Chinese companies, even without too much government overtly supporting them, are finding a way to expanding in emerging markets. So, and they all want 996, if not 12127. So it seems that one could also guess that the local executives in these Muslim countries that work in these Chinese companies, eventually maybe their own, you know, Jerry Yan and Jack Ma in those countries. So I guess my question is that U.S. by not letting Chinese in is missing out getting these data points to know what's going on around the world. And sure, for the short term, you prevented a Chinese company from coming into the U.S. But longer term, you're missing out what's potentially possible and not making the necessary changes that you need to compete on a global basis earlier.
Yeah. Well, I think any barrier, you know, I'm a globalist, so I think any barrier is generally negative. And you could argue that the U.S. being more protectionist now than before is missing out on certain trends that could be happening elsewhere in the world. And I think China has been criticized for the last 20 years for not
opening
benefiting
up
from the great things that maybe companies like Google and Facebook are doing. So, I think it's easy to point out that these barriers tend to have a negative effect. But also, over time, I think, you know, it remains to be seen how these different markets will develop. Because if markets that China now invests in end up more like China, and it's not just the market dynamics, but it's the way the government think about it and the trade and everything else. So I think the stakes are much higher. And I've come back to that theme a couple of times, but I think the stakes are much higher and it's more complex. And whoever wants to win in these markets now have to go in with much more at sort of more commitment than maybe they were able to do 10 years ago.
Right. That's fair.
So I wonder, out of the Chinese tech giants, which one do you think is best equipped to go global? And this is a question for both Hans and Jerry.
Wow. Face off, huh?
Jerry
okay.
First.
I think my original business was an internet portal or search or information business. And so I think of information businesses as a little bit easier to move around. And I would say, you know, Tencent is probably in that camp. They have an unbelievable asset in WeChat, and if the capabilities on WeChat is offered, you know, in other markets in its full capacity, I think it'd be very, very difficult for other people to compete. And yes, there is WhatsApp and obviously
Line
and I think I have them all. But you know,
yeah.
But I do think that the power of the network and the power of software is very easy to roll out now. Alibaba clearly is the other one that has payment as a potential way of entering markets, and their e-commerce is once they establish it, is very, very, very powerful as well. So, but in terms of being able to move quickly, I would imagine moving a messaging app around is probably a little bit easier. But
Tencent so far hasn't demonstrated the same level of commitment that Alibaba management team is at.
Yeah, I it's a great question. I don't know. I think they're happy to let the Chinese diaspora spread the WeChat for now.
Got it.
What about you? What do you think?
I noticed that the Alibaba Tencent generation of entrepreneurs tend to be over 45, some even over 50 years in age. And that's a generation that grew up still treating the West as, you know, where a lot of innovation happened. And there's a very healthy dosage of respect. The entrepreneurs that we're seeing that are between sort of age 30 and 40 grew up when Chinese internet market started to grow fast. They do respect the U.S., but there's a lot more ambition in their part to show that their way is a better way.
Yeah.
Look at the Chen Wei, Didi, or Zhang Yiming at Toutiao, or at Wang Xing at Meituan. All of them have shown more aggression at globalization. And even the younger entrepreneurs in Hangzhou that are used to doing stuff as cross-border are building companies that are exclusively focusing on China outbound now. And their aggression is even stronger than the Tencent or Ali to do that.
Yeah.
So I think it will be extremely interesting in the next 10 years. I like you, think that everything's becoming a lot more politicized. So Chinese companies are more likely to do well in countries that are politically friendlier to China.
Right.
And hence the Muslim countries and African countries and the Southeast Asian countries make a lot more sense. So it will be interesting to see what happens in the next 10 years.
Well, I like your answer. You're basically saying I'm old and you're young.
No, we're not that far apart age. So I have to look back younger entrepreneurs to give me a sense of yes, what's hopeful for tomorrow.
That's why we're all doing this. Yes. Stay young, right?
Stay young. Yeah. We can't, definitely by ourselves, we can't do that anymore.
Speaking of young people, I think your story of meeting Jack at an early age confirms the thesis that, and I've always felt this way, that we should judge people not just by who they are today, but also by who they could become in 10, 20 years. And now you're an investor. How much of investing do you think is judging people and like their future trajectory? And how much of it is pure business?
Well, it's a really good question. I think if you're investing at the stage that we are at Ame, it really is early stage, sometimes two founders in a garage and just with an idea. And so I would say anything pre-Series A, you know, seed or late seed, even some Series A companies, you're really, you know, 80% investing on the team. I think where they want to go, the market matters. I think the sort of the product idea matters, obviously. But it's very different than later stage investing. You know, if you're looking at a Series B or growth, then it does matter where you're spending all that capital to go to market. But before you go to market, it really is about the ideas behind the entrepreneur. And, you know, Hans knows this, but some of my most successful portfolio companies have started the company under one premise, and now they're doing something
completely different,
like almost 180 degrees different. And I think that you can only explain that by having invested in people who are, you know, doggedly persistent in solving problems and following where their gut instinct tells them to go.
And what advice do you have for people who are trying to develop this good judgment of other people?
Honestly, the more I've done this, and you know, we're coming up on 6 years here as an investor, the more it feels like it's luck. You know, it really is. I mean, obviously, I say that jokingly, but I do think that if you look at our successful entrepreneurs, there are people who are very experienced. There are people who are first time. You look at some of our entrepreneurs who failed multiple times. You know, some are very experienced and some are, and we all know, and certainly I believe that's the case for me personally, that building companies, starting companies, you have to work really hard. You have to prepare all your life to do it. You have to really do it with all commitment and full passion. But luck has a huge part to do with it. And for me to have started Yahoo when we did, it was really, I think, the good timing more than anything else. For me to meet Jack as somebody that, you know, that was one of my first people I met in China is blind luck. So I think you have to work hard and you have to prepare yourself. But I think luck is a huge part of making success. And I think if I had an algorithm to pick lucky entrepreneurs, yeah, that would be worth selling. But I think, look, you know, you look at cryptocurrency, right? I mean,
right.
4 years ago, yeah, who would have bet on it, right? So,
right.
So I think you really, and it remains to be seen. So I think it really comes down to, at least in my mind, understanding the rationale, how the entrepreneur thinks, what are their motivations are, how they plan to deal with adversity, how they tell their story. Sometimes just listening to somebody's pitch changes your opinion about, you
right.
know, them. Sometimes you look at the slide and you say, oh my God, this is going to be great. And you hear it and you go, oh my God,
oh God.
It's terrible.
Right.
And the opposite could be true too. So,
correct.
So to me, it's really a feel game and it's not about numbers. I don't know. I would say it's hardest form of investing because you just never know. You're really rolling the dice.
Another person you met early on is Masayoshi Son of South Bank. What do you think of his Vision Fund and how that's changing the VC industry?
Well, I think Masa, you know, from the first day I met him.
Was he different than almost
no,
anyone else?
No, I was
going to
say, right. I mean, you know, he is the most persistent, tireless, you know, he keeps pushing himself and pushing the people around him. You know, he makes bets.
Mm-hmm.
He makes big bets.
Mm-hmm.
And people remember a lot of his successes. Yahoo, fortunately, was one of his early successes. But he's also had plenty of failures.
Mm-hmm.
But he never lets the failures deter him.
He
just goes back and tries harder. And I think what the Vision Fund has done is allow him to achieve something that I think he's always wanted to do, which
mm-hmm.
is rather than being an investor that has some influence,
right.
but not, not
you know, influence.
Still a passive influence,
right.
like most investors are, quite right. frankly, even us,
yes.
you know, we can pound the table and if the entrepreneur doesn't want to listen. But in his case, because of the checkbook and because of the platform,
right.
you know, he has a very clear platform that he wants to build around AI and around IoT and around the emergence of cloud, that he feels like he can use that power of the capital to create the next generation platform companies.
To form a Keiretsu.
To modernize the Keiretsu notion. But I think, and you know, you're seeing the beginnings of that with Didi and Uber investments.
Of transportation, yeah.
And he's betting big on AI. He's a big believer in singularity. So I think he's very purposed, and I think he wants to do more than just being a passive investor and let's
right.
see portfolio companies grow up and sell it.
Yeah.
He wants to influence them. He wants to drive a certain direction. And it's a big, bold bet, and that's Masa.
Just taking a look at the ride-sharing market, I mean, he's an investor in Kuaidi that ends up being merged into Didi. So number one in China already. He's an investor in Grab, not a GGV portfolio. That's number one in Southeast Asia. He's an investor in Ola, number one in India. And by investing all these Uber competitors in the biggest markets outside of US, he ends up indirectly or directly, you could argue, to drive down the valuation of Uber. Now he can invest in Uber at much more attractive prices now. And yeah. after an investment, it may be easier to replicate it, the Uber China Didi deal in Southeast Asia and in India to have the local number one player buy out Uber assets locally so that Uber can devote more of that resource back home on autonomous driving, for example, or Uber Eats or other markets,
sure.
other business more profitable and more interesting and more disruptive. And so in some sense, he's trying to use the resource that he has to rationalize the market to form better Keiretsus. And
yeah,
he learned from the Alibaba Yahoo lessons
yeah.
to do it better now, the third
yeah.
time.
Well, and as you said, you know, it's to the extent that people compete and cooperate in different regions on the ride share as a market, for example, you know, it's a win-win-win, right? I mean, nobody's subsidizing and losing money and burning cash.
Yes,
and
everyone can be more profitable.
And for him, that drives up his investment, the asset value, right?
Yes.
So he's got a very clear view of how these things could be made to be successful.
Right.
But he's still got a lot to prove in terms of being able to really realize some of these things over time.
Sure.
But I think he's
like you say, he'll make his share of mistakes.
Yeah.
Right. But the ones that are proved to be a winner, like Yahoo, like Alibaba, is going to make a ton more.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
Yahoo's investment in Alibaba has been called the best investment an American company has ever made in a Chinese company. Which investment do you think has been the second best?
I think it's not an American company, but Naspers, you know,
invested in Tencent.
You know, people don't talk about that, but yeah. It's mind-boggling. And
they went in at what, $20, $30 million valuation?
It's incredible. And they own 35%, 30%, whatever
it is. 34%.
Yeah.
So, did not sell a single share.
There are these stories that that I think seem incredible now, but I think it's what makes this whole venture business so interesting is that, you know, it doesn't... For Jan and Brian to start WhatsApp and have 50 people and sell it to Facebook for $19 billion
right.
is those kinds of Silicon Valley stories or Beijing stories
right.
you know that makes every entrepreneur want to join
do this
but I also think, you know, we may be coming into an era where we might see more of those kinds of investments rather than less
mm-hmm.
because.
The scale is a lot bigger now.
The scale is a lot bigger. And, there's disproportionate kind of dynamics in the marketplace for the winners versus
the
losers.
Yeah. Number one player. Yeah.
And so I think that's going to be the big thing is who's the next winner in a very big space. And
a lot of people argue that today startups are pawns of big players, whether it's Fang in the US or BAT in China. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at investors, right, and you guys are one of them, and most investors invest thinking that, you know, on the upside, there will be the next BAT, whatever. But on the downside, they can sell it to one of these guys.
Right.
Right. And you've had plenty of companies, we've had plenty of companies that always come to this crossroad where I can go raise a lot more money, or I could sell a company. And a lot of companies, even if the entrepreneurs may or may not want to sell the company, a lot of investors will take the acquisition route. So I think, I don't think it's so much that startups are pawns. I think the investment community, and by the way, I think the large companies are much more savvy now.
Yes.
And the capital is coming not just from the traditional venture capital firms, but also a lot of corporate money and a lot of other money that's in the mix. So
especially with sovereign wealth.
And sovereign wealth funds really starting to play a role in, because you know they have to get the return somewhere, right?
That's
so
right.
So I think it's more complex than just saying companies are pawns.
Right.
I think really the investors are pushing for certain outcomes in most cases.
That are reasonably rational.
That are rational. And so, you know, it's very hard to find companies that want to be completely irrational for a very, very, very long time. You know, maybe companies like Magic Leap or something can do that. But it's very, very difficult for, I think, for a large number of small startups to be able to maintain and raise cash with their investors if there's an alternative to sell at an attractive valuation.
And we will actually argue that in the older days, the era you remember, 10 years ago, most of the Chinese startups run the risk of being cloned by the big boys.
Right.
They don't even bother to buy you or invest in you. They just copy
We can
you.
Build it, yeah.
That's right.
Right.
These days, since the competition amongst themselves is so fierce, you almost have this issue of a balance of power that you know they rather buy or invest to save themselves time to compete against each other.
Sure.
You can argue it's actually better for the startups than ever before.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're seeing a little bit of that in the US where, you know, I would say 5 years ago, the big internet companies in the US were much more acquisitive. And recently, I would say that, you know, they're much less so. There's still acquisitions here and there, but they're more disciplined. They're a lot less acqui-hires. Mm-hmm. There is a lot less of the, you know, billion-dollar outcomes for a few engineers kind of thing. So, I would suspect that China will go through that same phase at some point. And to me, these are just cycle of things, right? And so startups, in some ways, I think it's a much more rational world here in Silicon Valley now. You can't count on getting acquired 2 years from now. You know, you have to come up with something that
That's sustainable. Just flash in the pan. That looks cool, and if we're going to sell them.
And Hans, as you said, the big companies here are building everything. I mean, Google, you know, is building everything from, you know, autonomous driving to, you know, solving aging, and you know, so there's a wide array of activities that typically maybe reserved for the startups 10 years ago. Now the big companies are doing it very actively.
Right.
So if you're a startup and you're getting venture capital, you have to come up with something that the big companies aren't going to do.
Right.
And I think that's also a shift a little bit. You know, you have to solve problems that the big guys either don't want to solve or don't have time.
Or don't solve it fast enough.
Right. Or you have to be far out enough that they won't get to it.
Correct.
And that's a totally different challenge.
Yeah.
So looking forward, do you think the US and China tech ecosystems will become more integrated or more separate and enclosed? Because I feel like for every app in the US, there's an equivalent in China, and both ecosystems are just very separate, and like the people are separate and people use different things in different countries.
I think today if you I can't even name one really that app that you would use in the US, you know, to a high frequency that you would go to China and use. Maybe you can come up with one, but I do think that it's been, you know, two ecosystem, and we've talked about this. I think, you know, the evolution of the last 15, 20 years from copycat to indigenous product innovation to now indigenous business model innovation in China, that is really playing out. But there are, I think there are ways in which companies or the tech ecosystems can be more integrated. Eventually, things that run on the cloud here should run on the cloud there, and vice versa. Whether it's you know, sort of the B2B world or enterprise software world, logic says you don't really need two Salesforces.coms or two Workday.coms, which I'm on the board of. And so, you know, there's no real, you know, managing, you know, your enterprise probably is the same from a product perspective, cross borders and cultures. But I do think from a consumer standpoint, the consumer behaviors and the language and the cultures are different enough that you probably will see a separate ecosystem. And some of the basics like mail and messaging and maps and search, they're already fully developed in China. So I think it's hard to say those things will revert back to a more common between the two countries. So, and to me, it's no longer just about politics and saying, you know, the countries don't want to work with you. That's not the case. I just think the market's already developed fully. Yeah.
The cultural and language differences.
Yeah.
The only ones I can think of are more e-commerce companies, whereas Airbnb or Amazon, you can see people.
Yeah, but Amazon is not a big app.
It's not as big in China.
Yeah.
As it is here by a long shot.
Yeah.
But beyond e-commerce company, I think it's just very hard. That's why you pick Alibaba as a partner.
Yeah.
12 years ago. Yeah. And also, it seems like just on the point you made earlier about indigenous product innovations and indigenous business model innovations in China, it just seems that e-commerce and virtual item sale, anything that's non-advertising or is user-paid business model, are just becoming such a bigger influence than advertising.
Sure.
Which is not the case here. And that companies that know how to do that well to get users to want to pay for things are better at emerging markets in general.
Yes.
Because advertising in general is not as developed in emerging markets.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Advertising has really boosted Google and Facebook here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And probably, obviously Western Europe. But advertising as a business model is a very small percentage of all these countries, including China and a lot of these emerging markets.
Yeah. And so people pay for performance and also user pay for satisfaction. And it's hard to imagine 10 years ago that Chinese users would pay for anything. Now they fuel the growth of Ali and Tencent and everybody
else. It's incredible.
It's just incredible.
Yeah.
Last question I wanted to ask is on super apps. So actually just last week, WeChat launched their mini games and also made their mini programs more powerful. And I feel like WeChat is just becoming closer and closer to an operating system.
Yeah.
So for Chinese people, it doesn't really matter if you have iPhone or Android. If you have WeChat, it's the same. And but we've seen over time that, and with Yahoo as well, that vertically integrated large platforms tend to get attacked by more category-focused players. Do you think super apps like Facebook and WeChat are sustainable?
It's a great question. I think it is the case that if you are smart, you can continue to leverage the traffic and the eyeballs you have into more and more vertical applications. And so it's not surprising. I think, for example, Facebook has always worried that if they didn't have their own phone, or that if Android wants to cut them out,
right,
because they're not an operating system. But I think if you developed enough critical applications within the same umbrella, and it's interesting to see them embed some functionality. I'm talking about Facebook. It's interesting for them to embed some functionality within the Facebook app, and then they split off Messenger, and they've kept Instagram and WhatsApp separate. So it's a multi-app strategy in Facebook's case. In WeChat, I have not seen them go multi-app.
Right. It's all one.
They've really put it in one. And we've seen dangers of that. I invest in a company where try to do all things to all people.
Mm-hmm.
You run out of UI. Right. I mean, you're still talking about a small phone, right?
That's right.
So how companies can navigate that kind of growth is really tricky. From a product design standpoint, from a user perspective, it could leverage a lot of machine learning and AI to do that. But ultimately, I think, it depends on whether they are getting more back from creating these verticals rather than less, right? If you're creating a vertical and then you're getting less traffic back, then something's wrong. So I know the WeChat team a little bit. I think they're really, really, really smart. But I think, Zara, your point is well taken in that that's going to be one of their challenges is they have to continue to do messaging well. They continue to have to be able to do a lot of these, probably payments well. But should they get into every little thing there is? Who knows, right? And that means there's going to be room for others to either partner or come up with their own. Toutiao is a very interesting case study, right?
Yes.
I mean, there should be no reason Toutiao
be able to have so many apps
to have been existed at all.
Yeah.
And for them to have that is really an opportunity that he saw. So
right. When we were coming up with a question for this interview, the super app question was something that fascinated us. Because you could argue that Yahoo was the first generation super app that did everything. I mean, you did more work than Google ever did in the early days of the internet. That was so needed. And then you have Facebook and WeChat that doesn't need to do everything themselves anymore. Set up a platform that other app to plug into it because there are enough other apps around, you know, 10, 20 years later. And so if you look at that model and you look at what someone like Toutiao has done is take an app that a news aggregation that every portal has something like that.
Yes.
And somehow made that popular enough and frequently used enough to power another assortment of short form video app that's all user generated content. So it is going to be interesting to see how do you, what are the other ways you can build something that somehow the big boys is not going to notice.
Yeah.
It happened right in front of them. It's something they're kind of familiar with, but 5 years later, it's look completely different than what they expect to be. If you don't know how to do that, then you could be arguing maybe a pawn of the big company. But if you can get that right,
yeah,
you can always win.
Yeah, it's pick your battles, but also I think there is a underlying user need or demand that they fulfilled. And I think that's, because, you know, you're absolutely right, Hans, in describing what somebody needs to create. But this sounds like, you know,
Mission Impossible.
It sounds like finding a needle in a haystack and Mission Impossible. But for those people who end up doing it, they listen to their customers.
Yes.
And they learn from their customers. And it still happens every day. And that's why it's so fun to do what we're doing.
Right. Agree. My last question is around Apple in China. When Apple first went to China with iPhone, the government doesn't know what it is. It's interesting. It's just yet another phone. You know, phones are all commodities. No problem. You can enter. After 10 plus years, you know, it is no longer just a phone. It's a computer. It has a lot of sensitive data that any government would want to know more about. If you have to make a prediction, what does Apple need to do over the next 10 years to continue to do what they do in China?
Wow.
You could, it's almost an anomaly. Compared to Yahoo, compared to Facebook,
yeah,
compared to News Corp.
I mean, you know, Apple's always been cited as the most successful American company in China.
To date,
and that nobody talks about. And I think part of it is that they have, you know, and I understand, I don't know them very well, but I understand Tim Cook personally, even before he was CEO, spent, you know,
enormous amount of time
in China. So it goes back to sort of what we talked about.
Building that relationship,
understanding the culture, really finding that value add for the country of China,
mm-hmm.
And make that value proposition unique enough that...
You'll be allowed to do what you want.
Well, yeah, right. And it's not, I don't think it's a one-way street. I think no. There are some check and balances in China where you can't just arbitrarily decide Apple goes out, right? I mean, can you imagine
right.
the uproar? So there is a process. I think Apple has spent a lot of time investing, not just money, but also, you know, a lot of relationships and a lot of
value add,
both manufacturing and otherwise.
Right.
Look, I mean, I think the next 10 years is going to be very different, potentially, given that you know, this is, like you said, it's not just a handset. It's more of a software company. It's more of a data company than ever before.
And, yeah.
And as China works through their own thinking about cloud and how cloud works in China, and I would argue that's an area where they're still fairly early in thinking through,
yes.
you know, data regulations, regimes. You know, if I were Apple, I would spend the time to think through how they can be additive to that process.
Correct.
Like they've done. And so if they're smart and do the right things, they will continue to be viewed as a valued player in China. And if they aren't viewed as that, then they will have problems just like right. everybody else.
I think what their role in the whole DD Uber thing is not as publicized.
Right.
They could invest in Uber and then invest in DD. And that made a huge difference in outcome. And also, you see Tim spend a lot of time visiting Chinese startups these days.
Yes.
These are apps that are developed locally in China and doing well on Apple App Store in the US, in China. But many of them have ambition to grow beyond China. And to the extent that Apple could be a facilitator of a Chinese ecosystem exporting that outside of China, it kind of fits what President Xi is trying to do, extending China's soft power beyond China. And so you could tell Tim working very hard, much savvier than many other U.S. startups.
I don't know anything inside Apple, but it certainly looks like they have a plan that they've executed, you know, for well over a decade.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So for the last part of the podcast, we have a round of quick fire questions.
Okay.
First one is, who is the entrepreneur that you admire the most and why?
Besides you and besides Jack, who else do you admire?
Well, I think we talked about, the one that I'm really impressed by in China is Cheng Wei and Jin Liu. Yeah. But their combination is Didi is really incredible. Amazing. And Cheng Wei to me is one of the most, strategic but grounded entrepreneurs I've met. And so it's not a surprise that he's where he's at today. And by the way, I think he is, 12 by 12 by 7. There's never a time that he's not working, and it's incredible.
I have my share of super entrepreneurs that I have the fortune of working with. I think Cheng Wei is probably the fastest growing executive over the last 5 years, from where he was before to where he is now. It's the biggest leap I've ever seen in an entrepreneur. It's just absolutely astounding.
And a lot of people, say that he doesn't speak English, but I think he must understand it all because he's so intuitively strategic. It's incredible. So,
So it's been fun.
What's the best and worst decision you've ever made besides investing in Alibaba?
Oh, see, you can't keep saying that. Obviously investing in Alibaba turns out to be the best decision, but there were probably times people said that was the worst decision, right after I would say that,
starting Yahoo,
but I would say that a lot of times your toughest decisions are the ones that people will say it's your best or worst, and only time will tell. And,
which one is which.
Yeah.
What motivates you to wake up each morning these days? And what still keep you up at night?
Can I say doing a podcast with Hans? I feel like the energy that I see from a lot of our entrepreneurs, where a lot of them are moonshot ideas. That's the business I'm in, to try and invest in things that might change the world. Maybe it's one in a billion chance, but. And that gets me up in the morning, right? To know who I'm going to see and hear their ideas. A lot of it is also helping them navigate through building the company. But I think their passion and energy is really inspiring and kind of feeds, like we said earlier, it keeps us young and keeps us on the forefront of what's possible. Yes. And I think as human beings, that's really, that's really liberating.
Makes you feel alive.
Yeah. And yes, I think making returns is part of the scorecarding.
Right.
But in my case, I feel like benefiting from our entrepreneurs has been a real joy. Now, when they run into trouble, that's what keeps me up at night. So
that comes with the territory.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jerry. It was great to have you.
We've known each other for several years now and has been a very interesting ride together.
So, absolutely.
Look forward to have more.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Captain Lee speaking. Flight for board, Hainan Airlines, flight HU7989, bound for Minota, San Jose International.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 996. By the way, we also produce a weekly email newsletter in English, also called 996, which has a roundup of the week's most important happenings in tech in China. Subscribers have told us it is informative and fun to read. The newsletter also features original content and analysis from Zara and me. Subscribe at 996.ggvc.com.
GGV Capital is a multi-stage venture capital firm based in Silicon Valley, Shanghai, and Beijing. We have been partnering with leading technology entrepreneurs for the last 17 years, from seed to pre-IPO. With $3.8 billion in capital under management across 8 funds, GGV invests in globally minded entrepreneurs in consumer internet, e-commerce, frontier tech, and enterprise. GGV has invested in over 200 companies, including Airbnb, Alibaba, Ctrip, Didi, HelloBike, House, Keep, Slack, Square, Toutiao, Wish, Xiaohongshu, YY, and others, with 29 IPOs and 17 unicorns to date. Find out more at ggvc.com.
If you have any feedback on this podcast or would like to recommend a guest, please email us at 996@ggvc.com. This podcast is co-produced by our friend and business partner, Kaiser Kuo, the host of the wonderful Seneca podcast. It covers China's economic, political, and cultural issues.